We're going to continue with a lesson from the last hour, Darwinian Evolution Debunked, Part 2. We're going to look at four more frauds that are still taught in public schools today. We're going to look at Darwin's finches, Neanderthal man, alleged fruit fly evolution, vestigial organs, and also mutations do not lead to macroevolution, as we are taught. First of all, what about the dinosaurs? I think this is the most commonly asked question of me, and it's been asked this weekend, and commonly asked question of many individuals regarding evolution. Well, what can we point out about the dinosaurs? First of all, they've been one of the most powerful recruiting tools for evolution. Now, supposedly, the dinosaurs only came on the scene very recently in evolutionary history. If the universe is 13.8 billion years old, the dinosaurs only appeared 245 million years ago, and the humans at the very end. Now, how does this relate to the Bible? As a question was asked yesterday, how do we know that the dinosaurs coexisted with man? Well, I think if we believe the Bible, then we can believe that they coexisted with man, because the Bible teaches that dinosaurs and all land creatures were created on the sixth day of creation. Notice Genesis 1:24. Then God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind." And it was so. Well, why doesn't the Bible mention dinosaurs? Well, I think there can be some reasons for that. First of all, I mentioned this man's name yesterday. I switched him with Richard Owen. Gideon Mantell actually was the first that we know of to discover dinosaur fossils in 1822. And the word dinosaur was not even invented until 1841 by Richard Owen. I would suggest that dinosaurs were previously known by the name dragon. Not that dragons really existed, but human legend down through time about dinosaurs came to be known as dragons. In fact, if you take this T-Rex on the left and compare him to this dragon, we see some similarities. But if you take away the added imagination of the wings and the frills on the head, it looks very similar to a dinosaur. And the question is, why do dozens of cultures in the world have these dragon legends synonymous with dinosaurs? That's one thing evolutionists have to come to grips with. Well, scientists have speculated, even Carl Sagan. At least he proposed an idea, even though it wasn't accepted by creationists or evolutionists. He said the pervasiveness of dragon myths in the folk legends of many cultures is probably no accident. It is a worldwide phenomenon. Could the pervasive dreams and common fears of monsters which children develop be evolutionary vestiges of responses to dragons? We may be replaying the 100-million-year-old warfare between the reptiles and the mammals. So somewhere in the recesses of our mind, our evolutionary mind, we can remember when we used to live with dinosaurs, when we were some kind of creature that lived with them at the time. Of course, that is ridiculous, and no one accepted it, but at least he was willing to take a shot at it. Now, people have to have an answer or a response to this. Why are there dinosaur legends in cultures around the world, such as the Inuit Indians, the Sioux Indians, the Hebrews, the Greek, Danish, Wales, China, Egyptians, Iroquois, Poland, Cherokee, and Germany? Well, I would suggest that humans did coexist with dinosaurs, as strange as that sounds to many people in today's modernistic world. I think they're actually maybe referenced in the Bible. Notice Job, the 40th chapter, verses 15 through 18. "Look now at the behemoth which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See now, his strength is in his hips, and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze, his ribs like bars of iron." So he moves his tail like a cedar. Well, what kind of cedar would be represented in ancient or in the Middle East? Well, we know that the cedars of the Middle East are these large, towering, majestic cedars. So it'd be some animal that had a tail like a large towering tree. Now, in some of your Bibles, they'll have a footnote, or if you have a study Bible, it will say the behemoth is probably an elephant or a hippopotamus. Well, let me ask, does a hippopotamus or an elephant have a large towering tail like a cedar? Here's the elephant tail. Does it look anything like a cedar? I would suggest that it looks more like a hickory switch. Well, what about the hippo? Does the hippo have a tail like a cedar? No, it's a small stumpy tail, not like a cedar tree here either. Well, what kind of animal that ever existed, can we all agree, had a tail like a giant cedar? It would be the long-necked dinosaurs, such as the Apatosaurus or the Diplodocus. Large tails like the cedar. So, what do dinosaur bones prove? Oftentimes, they're said to prove evolution. Well, all they prove is that large reptiles once lived on Earth. Well, today we have large reptiles. 20-foot, 2,000-pound reptiles, crocodiles. And many people argue, well, humans couldn't have coexisted with dinosaurs because they would have been eaten by them. Well, humans are eaten by crocodiles today. That doesn't mean we don't coexist with them. We try to stay away from them, and if humans coexisted with dinosaurs, they would have tried to live in geographically distinct areas. And yet, it would be argued, we couldn't have lived with creatures that large. Well, the largest dinosaur was D. Schrani, but we have larger creatures than that today that coexist with us. The 200-ton blue whale. It would take three D. Schranis to equal one blue whale. And if the whale had become extinct, the blue whale, and we found his fossils today, people might argue, well, we couldn't have coexisted with the blue whales. They were too large. How can humans have coexisted? They would have overturned our boats. Well, we exist quite well, coexist with these. So what is the significance of dinosaurs in the evolutionary controversy? Well, listen to Derek Ager. He said, always it comes back to the dinosaurs. I must admit to being a little tired of those great beasts. Their importance is grossly exaggerated. Dinosaurs prove nothing regarding evolution. But I want to point out some more evidence that I think reflects the Noahic flood. There are limestone chalk beds composed of trillions of protozoa called foraminifera. They had calcite exoskeletons made of calcium carbonate, and they supposedly formed at the bottom of deep oceans over millions of years. We're told that the white cliffs of Dover, all these foraminifera that made up these chalk beds, were formed over millions of years. In fact, they said it took 1,000 years to be equivalent to 1 millimeter. Well, I would suggest that this was not developed. The sediment did not develop over millions of years. It is a result of Noah's flood when the water swept up the chalk beds on the bottom of the ocean, and there's actually a self-sorting mechanism where particles of the same size will sort together, be sifted and sorted together, and collect together in the sediment. We see these all around the world, the White Cliffs of Dover. We see them in Texas, in Alabama, in Tennessee, in Ireland, in Normandy, France, and in Israel. Now, if these developed over millions of years, let me ask you, why are there dinosaur bones buried in the chalk beds? If it took 1,000 years for 1 millimeter, how could a 1,300-pound Niobrarosaurus be buried in the chalk? I think we see a reflection of Noah's flood where they were buried very rapidly here. We also see a Claosaurus and a 10,000-pound Ankylosaurus being buried in the chalk beds, a result of a global flood. Also notice this, in 1962 and 1966, on calcite dolomite beds, and these are supposedly formed on the bottom of the seafloor, they found dinosaur prints. What were dinosaurs doing walking on the bottom of the ocean? I would suggest this is an example of the Noahic flood also. where the waters would recede and leave these calcite beds. The dinosaurs would walk over them, and then they would be covered up again. These weren't the bottom of the ocean. These were a result of the receding waters of the flood, as we see depicted in this picture. Another example of the dinosaurs and the global flood are massive burial pits, indicate that the dinosaurs died in a large flood. In fact, in Zhuxing, China, in the Shandong province, they were building a superhighway, and they found a 980-foot long ravine with 15,000 dinosaur bones buried in it, and they had to stop the project to excavate the dinosaur bones. How did 15,000 dinosaur bones become washed together? Well, I would suggest it was a giant global flood. Again, evidence of Noah's flood. These didn't develop slowly. It was very rapidly. And since I've been presenting this, many people have mentioned Dinosaur National Monument, where they found 1,000 bones in Utah in a very small area. Again, they were washed together in a giant flood. Evidence of Noah's flood. Well, dinosaurs allegedly lived from 65 to 245 million years ago. Yet, as we mentioned in the last lecture, why do we still find intact dinosaur tissues? Again, I think this is a result of being preserved from the Great Flood. They're not 65 to 245 million years ago. Here are some dinosaurs that represent findings of tissues and proteins and DNA: a seismosaur bone protein, DNA from a hadrosaur, hemoglobin from a T-Rex, and here's ichthyosaur skin, supposedly 19 million years old, and yet you can still see the details of the undecomposed skin. Soft tissue in T-Rex, and notice what A says here. The demineralized flat fragment is flexible and resilient, and when stretched, returns to its original shape. I don't think it's 68 million years old. Here's another one, Psittacosaurus skin, supposedly 125 million years old, hadrosaur blood vessels and protein sequences, mosasaur blood and retina. And when they carbon-14 dated this mosasaur, it was supposed to be 70 million years old. It only turned out to be 24,600 years old. And again, I believe that the radioactive decay was speeded up in the past. Collagen in T-Rex and hadrosaur, you know, a lot of people are concerned about their collagen today as we're getting older. Well, here's 68 million year old collagen. Well, how did the dinosaurs become extinct? Michael Benton says many hundreds of pages have been written about how the dinosaurs became extinct without our being any wiser. I think we really don't know. But creationists have suggested, I think this may be evidence for why they became extinct. And this is one of the evidences that convinced me of the Ice Age. These are glacial striations where glaciers would move across the top of rocks and create these striations and grooves and scratches in the rock. I think there was a great ice age, as we described yesterday, and Job discusses this also. And they may have lost the ability to feed. There may not have been enough food. If conditions were cold and not tropical, there would have not been enough vegetation for them to exist. So what is the significance of dinosaurs in the evolutionary controversy? Dinosaurs really don't prove anything regarding macroevolution, except there were large reptiles that one time lived. Okay, let's get into some of these other examples. These are some things that you're going to be taught in school. Darwin's finches. You're going to be taught that Darwin visited the Galapagos Islands in 1831, about 600 miles off the coast of Ecuador. And on these islands, about 15 different islands, he discovered 9 different finches. Now, because the finches were a little different, he decided that they were all different species. But he postulated that these came from the common ancestor of the South African mainland finch. So small changes in finches, they originally came from the mainland finch. How would you respond to that based on what we've studied so far? That's only variation within a kind, not macroevolution. Some may have had larger beaks to break seeds. Some may have had longer beaks to reach insects. And yet, this only proves variation within a kind. It does not prove macroevolution. You know, humans have different sized beaks or noses. But what does that prove? Variation within a kind. We're not evolving into anything else. What's the point here? There are fewer differences in Darwin's finches. Notice these minor, very minor differences than in the dogs we pointed out yesterday, in the Chihuahua and the Great Dane. And yet they don't say these are different species, and yet these are different species? Well, don't believe it when you're taught that in school. What's really going on here is that there's no new genetic information added. Genes are actually lost. So remember, evolution requires new genes, new genetic information. Well, what you should ask your teacher about Darwin's finches. So I'm going to put a little guy up here that's posing a question. And here are some questions you should ask your teacher. If Darwin's finches demonstrate macroevolution, what new genes have been added to the finch genome? And see what response you get. Humans vary in many aspects, different skin color, eye color, different height, and yet it's only variation within a kind. Next, were Neanderthals human or unevolved ape-like creatures? Were they a different species? And scientists equivocate on this and go back and forth, but the general response, as is seen on Wikipedia, I believe, is that Neanderthals were a different species. They were unevolved. Oftentimes, they are considered ape-like. Well, what is the difference in Neanderthal skulls and bodies and modern humans that live today? Well, we see some differences, yet I would consider them minor differences. They have thicker skulls, and that's supposed to be unevolved. I think some of us that have had accidents and hit our head or played football would have liked to have a thicker skull. They have larger ridge brows, and they have a 200cc larger brain capacity. In fact, they may have been more intelligent than modern humans. But I'm going to list a number of reasons here to suggest that Neanderthals were actually human. We know that Neanderthals created and hunted with weapons. They created and admired artwork. They set broken bones. They created musical instruments. Here's an actual flute that Neanderthals created. They made and used tools. They actually built and rowed in ocean-sailing vessels. They observed religious practices. We know that. They buried their dead with honors. And they spoke an intelligible language. They cultivated and used pigments. They cooked their food. And here's the kicker. Since the 1950s, secular scientists have even admitted that their anatomy falls within the range of human beings living today. There are humans today that have the same cranial capacity as the Neanderthal. They also lived at the same time as humans. They coexisted. Evolutionists admit that. They walked like humans. They acted like humans. And here's the second kicker. They interbred with humans. So they must have been some other species. No, I think we're looking at humans here, just variations within a kind. And yet they're often made to look very ape-like and disheveled. I would suggest if they're cleaned up and put some modern clothes on them, they might not look different than some other people that you see today. We see a lot of similarities. Now, here are three children that I'm rather partial to, and yet if you put the Neanderthal faces on them, they might not look much different than people you see at Walmart. And yet, you're often told that these are unevolved, ape-like creatures, cavemen. Well, here's Neanderthal man from the Mettmann, the Neanderthal Museum in Mettmann, Germany, and yet I think, again, we see resemblances to people today. And yet they say, well, look at the ridge brows. Well, look at Charles Darwin. He had large ridge brows. There are even people today that have ridge brows that are just as large as the Neanderthals. I have a few pictures of lookalikes that I'll flip through here real quick. So there are, again, if you clean them up, I think they would look like modern humans today. No different. Now, here's two individuals, Bao Jixun and He Pingping, the tallest and shortest man in the world at the time. And yet there's much greater difference between these two than between the Neanderthals and us. And yet they say they're the same species, and yet Neanderthals are a different species. Who can believe it? Next is fruit fly evolution. Regarding the fruit fly, when I was in the seventh grade, we bred fruit flies for mutations. And we looked for mutations that would change the eyes, change the feet, change the thorax, the abdomen, and the wings. And you'll be taught this in school because fruit flies can be mutated. That proves evolution. Well, the favorite mutation is the four-winged fruit fly, and that's often used to prove evolution. Well, what does that prove? Well, let's discuss that for a minute. I'm going to introduce you to a concept which we call the PBS principle. For neo-Darwinian evolution to be true, mutations must be P, persistent, B, beneficial, and S, structural. So they have to be passed down to the next generation, they have to be beneficial or able to outcompete their counterparts for survival of the fittest, and they have to be structural. It actually has to change the body type. It can't just be, as you'll be taught in school, pesticide resistance in insects or antibiotic resistance in bacteria. It has to change the structure. Well, let's look at this four-winged fruit fly and put it to the test. Is this mutation persistent? Is it passed down to the next generation? No, because the fruit fly cannot breed. The four-winged fruit fly cannot breed. Is it beneficial? Does it help him in the wild? No, the four-winged fruit fly cannot fly. Although it is structural, it does change the structure. It's not persistent nor beneficial. So here's what you should ask your teacher when they bring up fruit flies. If fruit fly mutations demonstrate macroevolution, what new genes have been added to the fruit fly genome? There are no new genes added. And yet that's what we are taught leads to evolution. I want to hammer this point now that mutation-driven evolution does not occur. So we're told that the mechanism of evolution is beneficial mutations. Well, I'm going to list 10 quotes from Darwinists that show that mutations are not good. Mutations are bad. Mutations harm and create a reducing process, not an advancing process. Notice what Soren Lovtrup from University of Umea said. The fruit fly, the favorite pet insect of the geneticists, seems not to have changed since the remotest times. And yet we're told that fruit fly mutations prove evolution. Well, they say for millions of years, the fruit fly hasn't even changed. I want to introduce you to a book I have up front here. This is the Altenburg 16. What happened in 2009, the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth, there was a private conference held in Altenburg, Austria. And the premise of the conference was this: mutations do not lead to evolution. We have to come up with a new idea. We can't let the general public know that what we're teaching is false, but we have to come up with a new idea that explains evolution. So let me give you the background of this. Darwinism reigned from 1859 to 1935. Now, Darwin, and we've been talking about neo-Darwinism, you might wonder what's the difference between Darwinism and neo-Darwinism. Well, here's the difference. What Darwin taught, his mechanism of evolution was very Lamarckian. It was based on inherited characteristics. That's just to say that I'll use an example of the giraffe. Charles Darwin believed in something called gemmules. And based on the conditions of the animal, they would pass gemmules to the germ cells or the sperm and the egg that would be passed on to the progeny. And with giraffes, they said because a giraffe was originally short like a horse, the neck was short, they would stretch their neck to try to reach up to the tree. And when they stretched it, these gemmules from the neck would be passed down to the germ cells. And thus, the next giraffe would be a little bit taller. And the next giraffe a little bit taller as they continue to stretch their necks. Or the idea that inherited characteristics, if you lifted weights and build huge muscles, and then you have a child, the gemmules would be passed down to the child, and he would have huge muscles. Well, by 1895, they knew that wasn't true. Because of who? Gregor Mendel and Mendelian genetics. They knew in 1895 that Charles Darwin's idea was wrong, but from 1895 until 1935, they knew Darwinism was wrong, but they didn't have a new idea. So between 1936 and 1945, they came up with the idea of neo-Darwinism. They took the creationist idea, Gregor Mendel, and combined it with Darwin's idea of natural selection and said mutations in the genes lead to evolutionary change. Well, here were those that developed the modern synthesis in 1936. These are some of the major players. We've mentioned some of these this week. So they came up with a new idea called neo-Darwinism. So what does that lead us to? Well, today, they know neo-Darwinism is wrong. Mutations do not lead to evolution. And so this is what they're looking for now, but they don't want the general public to know. It's called an extended evolutionary synthesis. They're looking for a new idea to replace neo-Darwinism. And that was the purpose of this conference. They gathered scientists together from the best universities in the world, 16 scientists, the Altenburg 16, to say, we need a new idea. We're in trouble today. Jerry Fedor wrote a book about this, and it's called What Darwin Got Wrong. He's an evolutionist, but he says mutations do not create evolution. Notice what he says. We've been told that even if Darwin was wrong to claim natural selection is the mechanism of evolution, notice this, nonetheless, we shouldn't say so, not anyhow in public. Why? Because all the textbooks since 1936 have been wrong. Well, here's the question. If neo-Darwinism is dead, what theory of macroevolution will replace mutation-driven evolution? That's what Jerry Fedor asked. Okay, so if Darwin got it wrong, what do you guys think is the mechanism of evolution? Short answer, we don't know what the mechanism of evolution is. As far as we can make out, nobody knows exactly how phenotypes evolve. Now, from my studies, I've come up with 26 proposed alternatives. Various people propose different mechanisms for evolution. Punctuated equilibrium, genetic flow, epigenetic inheritance, etc., etc., etc. But the fact is, in the scientific community, they're fighting amongst themselves, trying to find a new idea for evolution before the general public finds out that everything they've been taught is wrong. Here's a proponent of this. Notice what Lynn Margulis said. I have seen no evidence whatsoever that these changes occur through the accumulation of gradual mutations. She also said neo-Darwinism, which insists on the slow accrual of mutations by gene-level natural selection, is a complete funk. In the Altenburg 16, she said, the source of purposeful inherited novelty in evolution, the underlying reason the new species appear, is not random mutation. So do you remember all weekend we've been defining evolution as random mutation plus natural selection? That's what you're taught in school. What the best scientists say is that does not create evolution. There's another quote with Francisco Ayala. Notice this quote from Antonio Lima de Feria from the Altenburg 16. The experimental results have been available for 35 years. For 35 years, we've known that mutations do not lead to evolution, but have been ignored or silenced to avoid creating cracks in an edifice based on randomness and selection. So, what you should ask your teacher about evolution? If neo-Darwinism is dead, what do you propose is the real mechanism of evolution? Well, finally, the last point that you'll be taught in school, I was taught this from the earliest age on up to college, is vestigial organs. And here's the usual suspects: the tonsils, the tailbone, and the appendix. And the idea is that we used to use these organs in our evolutionary past, but we don't need them anymore. So they're slowly starting to disappear. So here's what you should ask your teacher. If vestigial organs demonstrate evolution, what new genes have been added to the animal's genome? Well, it's the opposite. It's not evolution, it's devolution. We're losing things. This has nothing to do with evolution. Notice what was said in 1997 in Encyclopedia Britannica. The appendix is believed to be gradually disappearing in the human species over evolutionary time. Well, Jerry Bergman and George Howe wrote the book Vestigial Organs Are Fully Functional and showed that all these organs that we're taught in school are useless actually have a purpose. Well, why does this argument of vestigial organs fail? First of all, even if organs could be proved to be vestigial, disappearing, what would that prove? It would prove devolution. You know, evolution involves gaining new features, new characteristics, not losing features, not losing organs. I was presenting a lesson to some of the young people and teenagers where I am at, and when I got to this point, one of the young guys raised his hand and said, "Our teacher said that proof of evolution is that some fish in caves lose their eyes over time." Well, in dark caves, maybe they lose their eyes. They don't need them. And the next generation, each generation, successive generation, has less use of the eyes. But is that evolution? No, that's devolution. Next, physicians and Darwinists even admit that no organ can be considered vestigial. Many evolutionists admit that vestigial organs do not establish Darwinism. Notice what was said in 1981. This is the year I went to first grade. Vestigial organs provide no evidence for evolutionary theory. Now, if we knew that in 1981, why was I taught that from 1981 all the way through school? I would suggest, again, because they don't have any better arguments. Well, let's look at some of these usual suspects. We're told the appendix is not needed. It's a useless vestigial organ. They say it's from when we used to utilize hindgut fermentation. We would ferment different foods in our hindgut. Notice this, the appendix, this is in the book Gastroenterology from 1976. Regarding the appendix, current evidence tends to involve it in the immunological mechanism. It's an immune organ. Notice what Dr. K.L. Moore said in the book Clinically Oriented Anatomy. He said the appendix is a well-developed lymphoid organ. I guess that closes the case on that one. Next, what about the tonsils? Have you ever been told that your tonsils are evolutionary vestigial? We don't need them anymore? Well, just look at Wikipedia. Even Wikipedia in 2008 said the tonsils act as part of the immune system to help protect against infection and helping fight off pharyngeal and upper respiratory tract infections. What about the coccyx or the tailbone? I remember specifically in eighth grade being taught that this is when we used to have a tail. We used to swing from the trees with the apes and the monkeys. And our tail slowly over time began to shrink, and now all we have left is this little tailbone. Well, I like to use this cartoon that I think illustrates it well, where this professor tells the student Vestigial organs like the human tailbone prove we evolved from animals with tails. And the student very kindly says, "Sir, there are 9 muscles that attach to the tailbone. It is not vestigial. The tailbone is used with those 9 muscles to uphold the pelvic girdle, to hold everything in place." Next, the wings of flightless birds. We're told that birds like the emu, ostrich, and rhea, they used to fly, but now they don't need their wings anymore, and they're just vestigial. Well, I would suggest these wings are useful. If any of you have ever had chickens, do you know what happens when a chicken gets extremely hot? It drops down on the ground, and it opens its wings and uses it as a crude radiator to radiate the energy or the heat. Also, they're useful in as balance when running, balance when breeding, and they're used to protect the chicks. So they are useful. Next, supposed hip bones in whales. I think this is the last one. So we are told that whales used to walk on the land kind of as cow-like animals. But then they evolved back into the ocean, and they slowly lost these feet, and all we have left are these hip bones. Well, that's a pretty easy one to answer. These hip bones are actually part of the reproductive system. If they didn't have these bones, they wouldn't be able to reproduce. So don't buy into the vestigial organ argument. So finally, in conclusion, I want you to notice this quote from H.S. Lipson. He was the head of the Department of Physics at the University of Manchester. He said, "In fact, evolution became, in a sense, a scientific religion. Almost all scientists have accepted it, and many are prepared to bend their observations to fit with it." So don't be deceived. 2 Peter 2, 1 and 2 warns us about those that would deceive us. "But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed." Heed the warnings of the Lord, and be careful and wary of speculative philosophy that is peddled as science. Thank you for your attention, and I think we'll take a 10-minute or so break now.